Well, let me say, I don't usually kiss people I'm going to interview. This is an interesting and perhaps dangerous mix of professional incest and personal nostalgia. And it is my first day on the job. And so I called our mutual friend Al Franken, the senator from Minnesota, and former comedian. And I said, Al, how am I going to handle this? And he said, well, Howard, you need to protect your journalistic integrity, so I want you to ask Ariana some very tough questions. Here's one for you to ask her. Ariana, how did you get so brilliant and beautiful? So I've run out of questions from Al Franken. And Ariana, let's start. We have known each other for a long time. I'm proud to say we've been friends for a long time. And I wanted to ask you just a little bit about your background, just a little bit, because you write about the middle class, and I think people want to know where you come from in that regard. And I think you did have a middle class upbringing, and if you would use that to just sort of concisely give us a little picture of how you came from where you came from to here right now.
Well, first of all, Howard, I think a question you could have asked me is, how did you get so lucky as to have Howard Fineman as a senior politics editor?
This is going to be a really hard-hitting hour.
He also backstage taught me, he tried actually to teach me how to pronounce Louisville correctly. So, Louisville. I'm working on it. Okay, I'm not there yet, but I promise you, by the end of the night, I want to be there. So, also, let me just say, I love this set.
Yes, it's great.
Okay, so it's like I want to live here. So I'm basically not moving. As I say in the preface to the book, you know, I remember growing up in Athens. My parents got divorced when I was 10. And we lived with my mother in a one-room apartment. So it wasn't so much that we were middle class. I think it was a little more precarious than that because my father was a newspaper man. And so,
and how ironic.
So he would start newspapers. He started successive newspapers, each one of which folded. And so as soon as it would fold, we would then be completely out of money. Then he would raise some money, and he would start another paper. So both my love for journalism and my fear of print started at a very young age. He also was... As a young man, he was publishing an underground newspaper during the German occupation of Greece, and he was arrested and spent the war in a German occupation, in a German concentration camp. And so when he came back and met my mother in a sanatorium, she was recovering from TB, he really kind of felt that he could write his own rules about his life. And one of his own rules was to be a serial philanderer. And when... And when my mother complained, he told her not to interfere in his private life. Don't try that at home. I don't recommend it. So he remained a really good dad, and I was always close to him, but always somebody who was tormented and had a hard time managing his own life. My mother, on the other hand, was like the foundation of my existence. And she was able to make me believe that I could try anything and that if I failed, she wouldn't love me any less. So there was this sense that failure was not shameful. You know, failure was not the opposite of success. So that meant I could take risks, I could fail, I could get up again, I could try. So when I literally looked at a magazine one day and saw a picture of Cambridge, and for some reason I said, I want to go there, and everybody else around me laughed at me. My mother said, let's see how you can go there. And literally, she actually managed to get two tickets and take us to Cambridge, to see Cambridge. We didn't see anybody. It was almost like a kind of visualizing where I wanted to go. And to cut the long story short, you know, I took my GCSEs, I got into Cambridge, and that was, of course, the turning point in terms of doing something in my life that would meant changing sort of the circumstances of where my life was going if I had stayed in Greece, which would have meant getting married early as opposed to late, which is what I did. You know, having children, having a sort of the existence that most of my classmates had.
Well, the reason I ask is because I think it takes somebody like you, perhaps, who appreciate what this country can offer in terms of opportunity, to be so worried about whether those kinds of things that your mother was able to do for you, and that sense of fearlessness that she gave you and the education that she helped give you, whether that's available now. And you say, you know, the title of your book is Third World America. Now, since you're an immigrant, that gives a special twist to saying that. And I would just paraphrase the Seth Meyers from Saturday Night Live, who says, Third World America? Really? I mean, are you serious about that title? I mean,
yes.
Tell us why.
I'm very serious, and I have kind of four sections in which I kind of build the case. Mm-hmm. Not that we are Third World America now, obviously we're not, but why we're on a trajectory to get there unless we course correct. Now, the book is ultimately an optimistic book because in the fifth section, and if you only have time to read one section, I highly recommend you just read the fifth section because ultimately that's what matters. If you just want to believe me as opposed to Howard, who doesn't, that we are going to be a third world country if we don't course correct, then the focus should be on solutions. But in terms of why, for me, the essence, the heart of America is the middle class. Otherwise, we're a country of extremes. And every third world country is a country of extremes. Every third world country has rich people, often living behind gates with security guards, armed, protecting their kids from kidnapping. Now, to worry about the middle class and to worry about working people in this country is not a left-wing position. I call it beyond left and right, because even the very rich should worry about it. Because who wants to live in America without a middle class? I mean, the great thing about this country is that it's not an envious country. It doesn't envy people who are rich. It's an aspiration, and upward mobility has always been sort of at the heart of that American dream. And now we have 100 million people whose lives are worse off financially than their parents were at a similar age. And in the last ABC poll, two-thirds of Americans expect their children to be worse off than they are. And leaving aside the statistics, because I feel actually, Howard, that the media are culprits of using too many data, too many polls, and not telling enough stories. So I try in the book to tell more stories, because I feel that's the way to capture people's imagination about what's happening. I mean, if I tell people here there are 26 million Americans who are unemployed or underemployed, sure, it looks like a big number, right? But it doesn't touch our heart. While if I say to you, there was Brenda Carter, this woman in Atlanta, who worked in the same job in human resources for 13 years, then she was fired, and she had to collect all the things from her office, you know, that she had put there over 13 years, and she filled hundreds of applications for another job and has not gotten another job, and how she's now gotten back to her mom with this New Orleans recipe for homemade praline candy, and she's making that candy and selling it online and trying to make a living that way. It's a whole different thing because there are millions of stories like that.
Ariana, if you had to list, and you do in your book, if you had to list two or three, the top two or three reasons why we seem to have lost control or lost hold of building the middle class in this country. And I think people would pretty much agree that over the last 20 or 30 years, that's started to be the case. People's absolute income levels are not growing except for the wealthiest people. The income gap is growing, as you say. It's like pulling a piece of taffy and it's getting thinner in the middle. If you had to pick two or three reasons why, what would they be? Looking at it in big picture terms.
Yes, I would definitely pick education because, as you said at the beginning, I mean, education has always been the gateway to the middle class. And something has gone very wrong with our education system, our high school and middle school and elementary school education system. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how many of you here have seen Waiting for Superman. That's just come out, but it's a very powerful documentary that I write about in the book, that really says in a very compelling way that getting a new education now has literally become a game of chance, that there are parents who care a lot about their children, who want them to leave the dysfunctional schools they're in and go to a school nearby or not nearby where they can get a decent education, and there are lotteries. And whether you get a good education depends on whether your number comes up. Now that to me is truly un-American. So now we have evidence that companies are outsourcing jobs, not just because you can get lower paid labor elsewhere, but because sometimes the skills are not here. And, you know, we're 24th and 25th in math and science among developed nations. So all those factors that have gone into allowing our education system not to be up to what it was.
Let's stop there then, as long as you brought up education. And in your book, we're skipping now to chapter 5, or section 5, you suggest that the problem, to some extent, if not a large extent, is the way teachers are organized and paid. Now, you talk about the teachers' unions and so on, and it's hard to decide who does a good job as a teacher. At the same time, if I read it correctly, you make a very good case that teaching to the test and the testing too much is not a good idea either. So if you're not going to, how are you going to judge the performance of teachers if you don't test in a generalized way? And tell us a little bit more about how you really would change education, because I couldn't agree with you more, having spent all these many years as a reporter and having studied the country. Education is the absolute key not only to the middle class, but also to the survival of our democracy generally. So tell us a little more about what you do about education.
Well, first of all, we need to celebrate good teachers and pay them even better than the best teachers in private schools are paid now. Because the difference a good teacher makes in a child's life is just the most important factor. Mm-hmm. So having said that, we cannot reward teachers based on seniority. We have to reward teachers based on performance. We cannot provide the kind of tenure that is basically independent of performance. You have data that show that only one in about 2,500 teachers loses their job because of inadequate performance, compared to one in, say, I think it's 57 lawyers and 97 doctors. So clearly, that doesn't make any sense. And we have actually created that system at the expense of the children. This system works well for adults and terribly for children. Mm-hmm. So that's what we need to change. That's the first thing. So this is not in any way to say anything against teachers. The exact opposite. It's really to value teachers, as Jeffrey Canada says, who's done incredible things in Harlem. You know, when people say, oh, well, it's the matter of poverty and where the kids are coming from, that's why they're not learning. No, Jeffrey Canada has demonstrated that children can learn anywhere if there are good teachers. But, you know, I was meeting actually with Joel Klein yesterday, the chancellor of the New York system, which has done some remarkable things. And he was telling me all the problems they have to resolve in order, say, for teachers to be able to offer breakfast to kids who come to school hungry. You know, all the things that they want to do, teachers want to do the best for their kids, but they are constantly thwarted by rules and regulations, which basically are making their job much harder.
Okay, so education clearly is one of the reasons why we've lost track of the middle class in America, and one of the ways to ensure its survival and revival. What's another cause of this problem, and what's the answer?
Another way is that we have allowed mortgage companies, credit card companies, to basically, as Elizabeth Warren puts it, fill their contracts with tricks and traps. And so we have credit card companies, you know, at colleges offering our children teaser introductory rates and contracts which are 29 and 30 pages that Elizabeth Warren says, you know, I'm a Harvard law professor, I don't understand them. And hidden in those contracts, which used to be a page and a half, are all the tricks and traps, like the fact that these rates will become 29 and 30%. My daughter, who is a junior in college, she has a credit card now that has a 30% interest rate.
Are you going to take it away from her?
No, I have a thing on my BlackBerry that every time she has to pay her bill, there's an alarm, and I call her, okay, if you don't pay your bill today, your interest rate will be 30%. But I don't think there should be 30% interest rates. No. That's usually.
Yeah, it is. It is.
And if anybody here, you know, reads their Bible, you know, the Bible is against usury. But the state of Delaware is not.
I couldn't agree more, but and all of this seems obvious, and yet I know on the site and in what you write and what you say, you express the feelings that a lot of people have, not left, right, not Democrat, Republican necessarily, that the financial services legislation, for whatever good it did, and for Barack Obama's, the president's ability to get Ms. Warren in through the back door, sort of, to be the head of consumer protection within.
Despite, you know, the objections of Larry Summers and Tim Geithner and the people he chose to advise him.
All right, well, you're sort of answering my question before I asked it. What happened to the bill? You know, something happened on the way to a real thoroughgoing reform, and I know that Arianna led a crusade to get money out of the big global banks and put them in Louisville banks. Yeah. But seriously, what happened? Was it simply a matter of overpowering money from the bank lobbies, or as you say, there are people like Summers and Geithner who, you know, came out of that world, right?
Well, I think it's both, Howard, and also that's in fact a third reason why the middle class is under assault, which is the tremendous power of all these interests in Washington. I mean, you know that extremely well. We have 26 lobbies per elected official. So the financial reform bill is, as we're sitting down here, is being watered down further because lobbyists are there now making sure that even what passed by the time is actually going to be enacted is going to be so full of loopholes that we don't know how much good, if any, it's going to do. It already did not address the fundamental problem, which was too big to fail, you know, ending the systemic risk that too big to fail institutions provide and that keep the taxpayer on the hook. You know, I think that private enterprise capitalism is the best system there is. But private enterprise capitalism does not mean that if you take excessive risks and you fail, the taxpayer is going to bail you out, you know. Ayn Rand would be turning in her grave now. And of course, in addition, the president made, you know, a couple of tragic decisions when he came into office. And they were putting Larry Summers in charge of economic policy at the White House and putting Tim Geithner at Treasury. You know, personnel is policy. If you're any chief executive, let alone if you are the chief executive of the United States, you know, basically, these are two brilliant people. You know, Larry Summers especially is brilliant. In the book, I have a section that I call Brilliant Mind, Toxic Ideas. You know, being brilliant is just not what has been missing in this country. You know, the people running Lehman Brothers were brilliant. The people running Bear Stearns were brilliant. What is missing is wisdom, leadership. You know, leadership is, you know, leadership is seeing the iceberg before it hits the Titanic. It's not having a high IQ. And the problem with Summers, I mean, the best way to understand Summers is to think of a brilliant scientist before Galileo. You know, he was a brilliant scientist, but he thought the earth was flat. In Summer's case, you know, he thinks that everything revolves around Wall Street. He believes that profoundly. And so once Wall Street was saved, he was convinced that the rest would follow. You know, he kept going on all the shows, calling unemployment a lagging indicator. And he missed the point that, no, it wasn't a lagging indicator. There were structural problems. And what they were doing was not enough to address them. And so here we are right now. Without, and that's really why I say we're on a trajectory to a third world country, without any plan to produce jobs. It's not that the unemployment numbers last Friday were really dismal compared to where we need to be, right? Yeah, yeah. It's that nobody can tell us how we're going to get from here to where we need to be.
Well, Arianna, let me ask you, though, what evidence is there, just to play the devil's advocate for a second, that the government has the wherewithal or the focus to do this properly? And I ask that because one could argue that some of the stimulus money, however good some of the projects have been wasted. You can argue that the program to administer the foreclosure program has been a mess. However lacking in wisdom Wall Street may have been, and I would add lacking in morality as well, how do we know and where can we look to positive examples of what government can do? You know, I know your history and I know that you're impossible to categorize politically because you believe in individual initiative, you believe in moral force in politics, you believe in volunteerism. You try to cover the whole waterfront, and I think you do, but point to me to a couple places where government has done what you think government needs to do more of and better.
Well, let's look at the stimulus bill. The problem with the stimulus bill is that it was inadequate. You know, Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, said you cannot jump across a chasm in two leaps. And that's what the stimulus bill did. You know, when I was listening to the president today, as I was getting dressed, talk about infrastructure. You know, as you know, Howard, I have an entire section of the book called America the Beautiful / the Dilapidated. Right. You know, we have, you know, our infrastructure is crumbling. You know, our water pipes, in many instances, date back to the Civil War. We saw in San Bruno, California, what happens when pipes are not maintained and people die and homes are destroyed. So even if we are at full employment, we would need a very bold, very substantive infrastructure program, you know, an infrastructure bank that can lead to public-private partnerships. A lot of that has been put forward. Really, really bold and dramatic. The president is talking about it now. It's a little late. Mm-hmm. What happened? Why wasn't he talking about it then? And why? I believe that you could have had a beyond left and right coalition around infrastructure.
Well, can I just say I agree with you on that because having covered all this, what Barack Obama decided to do, what he was told, I guess, by people like Larry Summers and Tim Geithner was just pump some money out there. It really doesn't matter how you do it. And the analogy I would use is to the Israelis who learned long ago how to put a drop of water on each seed. Because if you try to water the whole desert, it isn't going to work. And what Barack Obama was told was just ask the bureaucracy what their shovel-ready projects were. You know, what's in the pipeline? Anything that's in the pipeline anywhere, we're going to do it. And that sounded good because it was a big number, but it wasn't a focused number.
No.
And I agree with you. They missed an opportunity to have a bigger debate about a real infrastructure program in the country. And then, ironically, what made it worse is, and I know this from having talked to the president about it, and he said this publicly and privately, he said the biggest lie in government is the term shovel ready. So not only was it scattershot in a way, it wasn't even effectively scattershot in some ways. And now you see signs all around the country, this is a recovery project here, recovery project there, but that's not what you're talking about.
No, but I
couldn't
think
agree
that's,
more.
No, I totally agree with you. I mean, in Brentwood, where I live in Los Angeles when I'm there. You know, there's They just tore up a road and a rebuilding, and it says a recovery plan. I said, really? I mean, was this like a bad road? I mean, compared to what's happening around the country.
That's... for those of you who don't know the socio-geography of Los Angeles, Brentwood is probably not the place that most needs the recovering money. I think that's
my point.
That's your point, yeah.
But probably the local congressman or the local... Yes. City councilman, whatever, you know, got that earmark. And that's why people are upset. And what the worst part of it, Howard, is that now people who want to turn everyone against government in general are using examples of incompetent, ineffective government right. as proof that government in general does not work.
Right, which is why in the middle of this fall campaign, and I should say this is being taped in the midst of the fall campaign, somebody like Bill Clinton and the president, Barack Obama, are going around trying to explain what good things they've proposed and what legislation they've passed. But the mood in the country is such that people, almost against their own, often against their own interests, don't want to hear it. Now, you've studied this country for a long time. You know a lot about protest politics. Where did the Tea Party come from, in your view, and what does it mean? Does it have any deeper meaning, and if so, what is it?
It definitely has a deeper meaning. I think those who dismiss the Tea Party movement as racist are missing the point. You know, there are racist elements in all parts of American society, including the Tea Party movement, but that's not what drives the Tea Party movement. What drives the Tea Party movement is anger. Anger at the establishments, anger at all the establishments that have been complicit in getting America to where it is now. It is an anger that I share. It is an anger that most Americans I talk to share. I was speaking recently in Minneapolis at the Teamsters Convention. And I remember sort of standing on stage and looking at a sea of faces that looked like they had given up. And underneath a resignation is anger. But they don't know who to direct the anger at, because they know that they don't want to direct at the Democrats in charge, because they know that when the Republicans take over, if they do, and we'll know by the time you're watching this on television, it will be worse for them. But the anger is real. And that anger has to be addressed. Now, if it's not addressed in the proper ways, it's going to be addressed in extremely destructive ways for the country. It's going to be addressed by demonizing particular groups, whether it's Muslims or immigrants or Jews. It's going to be addressed by turning us against each other, and it's going to end up destroying the country. That's why, for me, the most important thing we can do now is to channel that anger into constructive, creative ways.
Well, I think some of that's already happening. I think some of that's already happening, and you just have to look at the tenor and the content of a lot of the political advertising in this campaign season that we're in the midst of to know that, which leads me to another question. What can we do about money in politics? You say in the book that in the fifth section that you're for public financing of elections. Maybe that's the way to go. But what can we do about it at this point? What's your answer for that, if you have one?
Well, I think that public financing of campaigns, for me, is the mother of all reforms. It's like there's really no other way to deal with what money has done to our political system. I mean, you mentioned earlier foreclosures. And if you want to see one example of how broken our political system is and how dominated by special interests, look at what happened to the Cramdown Amendment, you know, that Dick Durbin tried to push through the Senate. After the banks had been bailed out by the taxpayer, you would have thought they were at a rather vulnerable point and that they would not be able to defeat Cramdown legislation.
Well, that was a bill to make the... require the courts to reconsider the terms of mortgages
right.
to lower the interest rates for people who had exorbitant and or very highly adjustable mortgages, take it to the courts and at least give them
yeah, provide some opportunity for loan
right.
modification.
Right.
Basically give people a chance to save their homes. It could have, if it had passed, it could have saved over 1 million homes. Now, look at how the world has changed. Just last week, when a notarization bill was passed, which would have made foreclosure easier and therefore harder for homeowners to fight it, the president vetoed it. He could have vetoed that legislation without the cramdown amendment. But at the time, they really, again, were missing just what a calamity foreclosures were going to be. I don't know how you can miss it. I mean, I don't know. As a mother with two children, I just cannot imagine anything worse than being thrown out of your home. You have so many families now moving into motels, moving in with relatives. I was talking to someone earlier here about the number of homeless children here in Kentucky. I mean, I think we need to really increase our empathy index as we are increasing the misery index in the country, because otherwise we're just not going to be able to turn things around.
You know, people have an impression of you perhaps because of the site, or I don't know why, that you're a cheerleader. I know you're nobody's cheerleader, but I wanted to ask you why you think it is that the Obama team, which ran such a brilliant campaign in which they seemed to have an almost perfect fingertip feel for the country, in which they got 52%+ of the vote, which by modern standards is a landslide, other than Larry Summers and Tim Geithner, whom we've already discussed.
Would you like to know more about
No, that's all right. what happened? What do you think happened? And is it inevitable? Is it inevitable that any presidency, any insurgent presidency or non-insurgent presidency that comes to Washington is suddenly going to become blind?
I don't think it's inevitable. I interviewed David Plouffe after his book came out. You know,
and he was here recently, I believe. Yeah.
The Audacity to Win. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote a piece and I entitled From the Audacity to Win to the Timidity to Govern. Because that's what happened. The audacity disappeared. And David Bromwich, who is a professor at Yale, whom you know, wrote a piece on the Huffington Post in which he tried to explain what happened as Obama's reverence for establishments. In the end, you know, Obama listened to the military when it came to Afghanistan against his better instincts, because remember, Obama would not be president if he had been in the Senate and had voted for the war in Iraq. His main distinction with Hillary Clinton was that he had gotten it right on Iraq. And he had given that powerful speech in Chicago in 2002 when he said, I'm not against wars. I'm against dumb wars. Now, Afghanistan was not a dumb war when we launched it, when it was a legitimate response to 9/11, since that's where Al-Qaeda was. It is a dumb war now, because Leon Panetta himself admitted there are fewer than 100 Al-Qaeda operatives there. We are dealing with a government that we are propping up, which is corrupt, with a slightly deranged leader. We are killing civilians inadvertently, therefore losing the war for hearts and minds. At the same time, China is spending billions of dollars mining the precious resources of Afghanistan and rebuilding its industry, while we, like a declining empire on the way to being third world America, is basically pursuing military adventures we cannot afford and which are not making us more secure.
So you're... So I think what you say in the book is, out of Iraq, out of Afghanistan. You want the United States out. How do you do that? Quickly? Now? Well, immediately? What do you want?
You know, the president gave a deadline of July 2011, which has been undermined by everybody around him, including Joe Biden, who was against the policy, as we found out during all the discussions and deliberations. And now he said that they're probably going to withdraw 2,000 troops. That's nothing. So, yes, they're not serious about withdrawal. General Petraeus is not serious about withdrawal. And that's where you need a leader. That's where you need a leader to say that the military is under civilian control in this country and that he has to make the decision. And that's where the David Bromwich analysis of reverence for establishments comes in, because the military always wants more forces. Mm-hmm. We've seen that again and again in this country.
Well, I want to ask you, since you've mentioned leadership, about the media, of which you and I are both a part.
And now joined at
a partner's desk. It's not really a partnership.
It is.
No, it's not. This is a difficult to lead nation. And as anybody who studies the founders know, they were fighting with each other all the time and arguing with each other and disparaging each other, et cetera. I wrote a book on that topic. But there seemed to be some kind of residual glue of respect somewhere for the possibility of leadership. You know, it's difficult in our country because we basically think all of us are created equal, and it creates the paradox of how do we lift someone above us to be a leader when we're all supposed to be the same. It's oversimplifying slightly, but I think that's our great conundrum as far as leadership is concerned. Are we in the media helping or hurting the process of finding leaders and building community? I think I know the answer. I think after 30 years in the business, I think we've hurt them both. And if that's true, then let me leap ahead to the question of what do we do about it without seeming like we're propagandizing for people?
Well, one of the problems is that we tend to follow the next or the last shiny object, as John Stewart put it, whether it's Balloon Boy, you know, remember the sort of breaking news? You had anchors emote about, I hope it's not too cold up there, so he's not so cold in the balloon. And I thought to myself, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of homeless children here, poor children. Maybe if we constructed a huge balloon and not even put them in, pretended to put them in, we might get like 10% of that emotion and sentimentality for them, as we got for Balloon Boy, who ended up being Attic Boy, really. And then we had the same kind of completely disproportionate attention paid to Reverend Jones, you know, a nut job from Florida with 30 followers who threatened to burn the Quran, and suddenly we're covering it in that breathless way again. So, and then again last week, you and I were both called on to address a major breaking news in the country, which was, would Hillary Clinton replace Joe Biden as vice president?
Now, well, I think that was a very legitimate story.
So it was, and again, this was like a celebrated reporter, Bob Woodward, who made it up from whole cloth. If you follow what he said, there was absolutely nothing to it. He said, and he actually...
I'm not going to agree with her on that one,
okay,
by the way.
He had to walk it back, because he said it's on the table, and then he said everything is on the table. Everything is, he said several Hillary Clinton advisors. He did not say how many. Is several two? Is it 10? Are these advisors working for her at the State Department? Are they her hairdresser? What are they? You know, it's basically, it's like everything that they, you know, everything that those of us in the new media are being accused of doing, you know, not properly sourcing stories, you know, anonymous sources, not even numbering them, let alone giving us something more than advisor, like working for her, previously working for her, nothing. You know, the kind of vagueness that plagued all the sourcing of the WMD in Iraq. Remember the Judy Miller case? And then on top of it, we just all wasted a 48-hour news cycle debating it. And then I went back to 2004, when a similar thing happened around who is going to replace Dick Cheney. You know, George Bush is in trouble, therefore he will need to replace Dick Cheney. Is it going to be Rudy Giuliani? And it was, again, the same endless conversation, the same kind of narcissistic conversation. I could use a worse word.
Yes, right.
But
I think I know
Christine
what it is.
O'Donnell would not like it.
Right. Well, I think there's a big difference between Judy Miller and Bob Woodward.
Yes, okay. But you know,
But
there is also the lure of access, and that's another problem with our media.
Well, Bob Woodward does what he does, and I happen to think, as somebody from the traditional media, you know, when Ariana was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "Well, Howard is coming with us because we want to combine the best of the old with the best of the new." I said, "Ariana, could you say traditional or something like that?"
Well, she said, been saying traditional.
Yeah, I know she has. I've been listening. But not to sound too traditional, but I do think that Woodward does work very hard and in many ways is a model. Now, it is true that he's an access guy, but he doesn't pretend to be otherwise. And I think his accounts, while not the end of the story about history, are a good first draft in many respects. I'll defend him to that extent. But I completely agree with you about the Beltway and about our narcissism and about our insularity. And that's why, number one, I want to say that the best thing I ever did in journalism was to spend 4 years here in Kentucky. Because I learned how to drink bourbon, and I know the state from Pikeville to Paducah, and I want to say too many reporters today think they just go straight to New York or Los Angeles or Washington and don't try to understand the country. And also, when you get outside the Beltway, you see things completely differently. Today I went over, luckily I was outside the Beltway, partly to come here, but I took the time to go over to Lexington and see Bill Clinton headline a rally for Jack Conway. And if I can just take a second, I'll tell you it was fascinating because Bill Clinton spoke for about a half hour and made the case for the Democrats better than I've heard anybody make it. That's Bill Clinton. You got to get outside the Beltway, and I'm going to say about the Huffington Post, which is my new home, that there are lots of really good reporters there, and they do a lot of really good work. And these days, when you get out into the country, you don't just get out into the country physically, you get out into the country digitally, because so much of politics now and a lot of our life is conducted on the internet. So one of the things I see that's important about the Huffington Post and about what Ariana is doing is to go there, meaning to go out into the digital world and report what's happening there. Let me ask you another journalistic question. There are people at some newspapers, including maybe the one here in Louisville that I used to work for, who want to know how your site is going to square the circle in terms of business model and also help address the problems that you're talking about here. Those are two questions. Mm-hmm. But one, the business model, the other, if this is heading to a third world country, what can the is there anything that the Huffington Post itself in journalism in general can do about it?
Yes, absolutely. Let me address that first and then the business model. I feel that what we're trying to do, and I'm sure we'll do better now that you've joined us, is to put flesh and blood on the data, to actually capture the public's imagination about what's happening out there. 2 years ago, I asked one of our reporters, Arthur Delaney, to just make his beat, nothing but putting flesh and blood on stories. And we were teasing him that we were going to call him our economic suffering correspondent. We called him our economic impact correspondent. Now he's been joined by one other reporter, Laura Bassett. And they've become like a hub where people just send them thousands of stories from around the country. And they've sort of internalized what's happening. You know, they really care for these people. I mean, we had an interview with Nancy Pelosi, so Nico and Sam and all the people, you know, all of us went to her office for that interview. And Arthur literally, after we all heard her say, well, it was during the time when they had not yet passed the unemployment extension, do you remember? Mm-hmm. So Arthur was getting all these anxious emails from everybody that he was connected with about what was happening, because he was also connected with a lot of the 99ers whose benefits were expiring. So he actually turned to the speaker and said, "So, Madam Speaker, what can I tell my people?" And it was like he felt like they were his people, that he had to tell their stories, that was his job. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. I mean, I was in Atlanta on Friday when the unemployment numbers came out. And there were three stories during that day that summed up for me what was happening in the country that the numbers did not capture. One of them was that the woman, Brenda Carter, that I write about in the book, lived in Atlanta. So I was going to do Good Morning Atlanta and asked the producer if they could put her on with me. And they said, "No, you know, we really want to talk to you." And I said, "You know, talk to me. You know, it's not like I'm going to say anything I haven't said. Have her on because she's here. She's like she'll put a face on what's happening." So they said no. So I said to Brenda, "Just come along in the morning." So she came and she brought a big basket of the praline candy that she makes. So we put it on the front. Anyway, they had her on with me and she was so moving and so powerful because she was so dignified and she was so like doing everything she could to rebuild her life. You know, after she talked about how she had been depressed, she was kind of giving up, and then she, like in a very American way, took matters into her own hands and is trying to turn her life around. Then I was speaking at the Coca-Cola offices, and Mukhtar Kent, the CEO, had put a lunch together with Atlanta leaders, and I was sitting next to Dr. Franklin, who is the president of Morehouse College. And he said to me, not prompted, he said to me, "You know, I had a hard night last night because I had a call from a mother who told me that they had to take their son out because they could no longer afford the tuition." And she said, in a very dignified way again, she asked me, "What was the best time to go and remove his belongings from the dorm so as not to produce embarrassment?" Mm-hmm. And the third story was one of the employees at Coca-Cola, where I spoke, said to me afterwards, she said, "You know, I have a good job, I have good benefits, I'm in a stable company, but my sister has lost her job. And she's a single mom with two children. So now my paycheck has to support that family as well." So Howard, that explains what's happening in the country. It's not just the people who are out of work. It's the people who are still working, but who've been touched by what's happening because a family member has lost a job or a home, because the child of a friend cannot get a job. So it's everywhere. So that economic anxiety, that's what I'm trying to capture in the book, is not isolated the way it was during the dot-com collapse.
Well, can you combine, I'm not sure everybody is fully aware of the fact that your site, what makes the site unique is that it's a combination of a news site and a social networking site. It's a community, as Arthur, the reporter, saying, "These are my people." That's maybe newspapers have been like that when they do crusades. I mean, it was true in the newspaper business too. But is there a problem in that? In other words, is there a line, or do you think it's a false distinction between being a journalistic operation and being an advocacy one on behalf of some people?
Well,
or how do you balance
that? I think there
that?
Is a line. And the first line is a reverence for facts. Like, you cannot cross that line in pursuit of helping your people. You know, that like, first, and I mean, for me, journalism is about ferreting out the truth, revering facts, accuracy, fairness. That's paramount. Beyond that, Upton Sinclair was a crusading journalism. And there's something about crusading journalism during times like this, which is essential, which is needed. You know, we're not living through plateau times. We're not going through the 90s. Mm-hmm. John Stewart asked me the other day, "Isn't it enough for someone to just do their job, take care of their family, you know, lead a good life like that?" I said, in normal times, it's enough. Today, it's not enough. It's like we all have to do our part to give back, to do something for the community. It's not enough to just say, "I'm taking care of my family." And that's something which is really what I'm trying to say in the final part of the book, which is to celebrate what's already happening around the country in that respect. Like, not out of Washington, not with politicians prompting, what people are doing to turn things around. And one of the most moving stories for me was the story I wrote about Seth Reams, who was the unemployed concierge in Portland, Oregon, who lost his job. He filled about 500 job applications, did not get another job, and he suddenly realized that the one thing he had in abundance was time. So he created a site called WeVeGotTimeToHelp.org, and he brought together his social network, and they've helped thousands of people. Sometimes it could be something really small, the way he describes it, you know, like a woman would call them and say, I'm pregnant, I need to move from my apartment, and they would find a truck and go and help her. And what that did is that it changed the way he saw himself. Instead of looking at himself as a victim who didn't have a job, was worthless, you know, he began to see himself as somebody who was empowered, who was contributing. And I've been talking about him everywhere. So now he has 50 cities that want his help to start branches. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
so
when
you're covering that on the site.
We're covering it on the site. Yeah. Kind of relentlessly. Mm-hmm. We also, through a not-for-profit that I've created, not part of the site, we've helped him create a not-for-profit so that he can have a little bit of an infrastructure, because he emailed me the other day, he said, Ariana, I'm so busy and I don't have a job.
Well, I know this is something you've written about a lot and talked about a lot, and it's a moving part of the book where you actually quote Sebastian Junger, whose book about war and the reality of war in Iraq led him to try to understand the psychology of the troops over there and why they formed such a tight bond and why the experiences that they had in that hellish environment left them, in a way, when they came back, those who were not damaged in other ways, sort of lacking in meaning in their lives. And you say, I think very movingly in there, that he talks about that their experiences in war gave them a sense of unshakable meaning. And you say, and I think you're right, that we are all hardwired to seek out unshakable meaning. And that's ultimately, I wouldn't say a religious message, but certainly a communal one. And, you know, if you know your Kentucky history, you know that Kentuckians love to talk proudly about their independence, but there's also a tradition of barn raising in Kentucky. The barn burns down, everybody gets together and builds it back, at least they used to. And I think that's what you're talking about here, and I think that's sort of what one of the things that intrigued me about the site and about your book is the combination of policy and values. And I guess you can't choose one or the other. The individual initiative and the sense of community or government. I guess you need both. So I guess I shouldn't ask you to pick one if you had to pick one. But since this is the interview, I'm going to ask you. If you had to pick one, which would it be?
Well, what I'm saying in the book is that we obviously, as you said, need both. Right now, in the foreseeable future, and of course anything can dramatically change from one day to the next, I don't see how the kind of bold policy solutions that we need are going to come out of Washington. So given that, we need to put our focus on what's happening in the communities. And again, what Edmund Burke called the little platoons, what liberals are calling sort of expressions of compassion and empathy, and coming together, whatever you want to call it, what you said about the fact that we are hardwired for meaning, you know, I write about the fact that we don't just have three instincts, which is what most psychologists and biologists say we do have, you know, survival, sex, and power. We have another instinct that I call the fourth instinct, which is the instinct for meaning, the instinct to make our life about something more than just our own preoccupations about success or money or sex or whatever pleasure we're seeking. All that is important, but it's not ultimately what fulfills us. And when we find what really fulfills us, it has to do with making a fundamental difference, whether it's in our own little corner or in the world. And, you know, there is a whole literature around that, a religious literature, you know, humanitarian literature, whether you're a believer or not. I mean, that for me is just an unshakable foundation of a good life. And when the founders, and you write about that, talk about the pursuit of happiness, it was not the pursuit of pleasure. It was the pursuit of something much more fundamental. And, you know, Sebastian Junger, I love that part, you know, that, thank you for quoting it. You know, he talks about necessariness. I love that word. When you have a sort of necessariness, that you are necessary to each other. That was the bond that they had in those foxholes. Mm-hmm. And that gave a meaning to their lives, that despite all the horror of war, they were missing when they returned to normality.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that we're in a foxhole of a kind now, because we face tremendous challenges. You've talked about it in terms of the middle class. It's true of poverty in the country, which remains intractable and extensive. It's about redefining what our role is in the world as a great nation and as an empire, which we are, whether we want to be or not. And I think covering politics now for a long time, you know, I wrote a whole book about the virtue of argument. And I believe that there are these enduring arguments that never end and shouldn't end. But the problem is, if you deny the humanity of the person you're arguing with, it isn't really an argument at all. And what I worry about is that, well, yeah. Thank you to the human beings out there. And another thing I like about the site, and I'm just going to keep reciting things I like about the site, is that the commentary, if you read the site, there's tremendous amount of commentary on the site. Comments from all over the country, all over the world, all walks of life. Ariana and her people make sure that they try to keep them civil. And I think what you convey there is a sense of respect for diverse opinion and strong argument. You know, you're Greek, you know about that. And we took a lot of our faith in that from you and from Greek culture. I just hope we can keep talking to each other without tearing each other apart, and I hope you can keep helping us do that. I've run out of questions. Do you have anything you want to say for a couple minutes?
Yeah, I want to say something about that. I completely agree with you that that's one of the main dangers we're facing. And that's why I feel that when people are in the grip of economic anxiety, it has been proven historically that they begin to respond to the world from their lizard brains, you know, which is where fear resides. I mean, this is actually scientifically proven. They may use fancier names than the lizard brain, but the bottom line is that then people become impervious to rational argument. So they can believe that Obama was a Muslim or a socialist or a communist or a Nazi, whatever, and you cannot really sit here and argue with them. You can show him 20 different versions of his birth certificate. That will not make any difference. So the way I see it is that the main countervailing force now is that while there's this appeal to people's basest instincts, most primitive instincts, we need to do everything we can to appeal to people's better angels and see who wins at the end. We don't know. But I think the appeal to the better angels is through all this explosion of caring and compassion and creativity and resilience that you and I and our colleagues in the journalistic field need to put a very bright spotlight on, because that's the only way to accelerate. And, you know, Diane Sawyer, who did the first interview on the book, completely agrees with that. And that's why I was so happy to see that she has committed her, you know, the evening news to go around the country and spotlight what's working. And she started here.
In her hometown.
In her hometown. Right. And then Joe Klein, who went around from Time magazine, you know, he went around the country and again, was talking to real people. And when I saw him, he had just come back, and he and I were doing the Bill Maher show last week, and he said to me in the green room, he said, you know, Ariane, he said, my writing will be different from now on. So I think a lot of people, both in old media and new media and the hybrid that we're all creating, are waking up to the need of that.
Well, we just have to make sure that the internet and digital technology, which can actually reinforce people's prejudices very powerfully and speak directly to that lizard brain that you're talking about, doesn't take over the dynamics of our medium.
Right.
And I say now our medium because I'm fully a part of it. I want to thank one of the better angels, Ariana.